Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We've said it before, we'll say it again. Ben Bernanke is the most powerful man in the world. We're teeing up the interest rate debate on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on mileage and safe driving habits. Learn more at progressive.com. And by iShares Exchange Traded Funds. Learn more about their ETFs at 1-800-iShares or iShares.com. iShares, keep evolving.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, today the 26th of April. Good to have you with us. A quick check of the calendar tells us that it's been almost 2.5 years, 28 months if you're counting, since the Federal Reserve cut its short-term interest rate to near zero. We mention that because today Mr. Bernanke and the gang started a two-day meeting in Washington, a meeting at which, in theory, they are thinking about whether to adjust rates. In reality, nobody's expecting any movement. Consensus seems to be that the first rate hike, if and when it comes, is at least several months away. Marketplace's Bob Moon has more now on the push and pull of monetary policy.
Neil Kazanowski is a financial advisor in Port Charlotte, Florida, where he has a largely retired clientele. Many of his customers at Raymond James have seen their investment portfolios shrink in recent years, and now they're finding it next to impossible to catch up. And Kazanowski says the traditional safe havens are no longer a realistic option.
I can't with a good conscience tell somebody to purchase a 5- or 10-year CD knowing we're going to have to deal with inflation and the dollar down the road. That would be something that would make me feel really horrible. You know, my clients actually feel like they're almost putting their money under their pillow.
The AARP's Legislative Affairs Director David Certner says that's put many older Americans in a tough spot.
People who've lost a lot of money are faced with this choice of having to invest more risky to try to catch up or to gain more than they maybe have lost in the last 10 years.
Certner says even Americans who haven't reached retirement age are faced with working longer hours to save more. Critics of the Fed's easy money policy also complain it might actually be harming the recovery. John Michelson is an investment manager in New York.
The beneficiaries of the rates haven't been spending anywhere near as much as the people who are being impacted have lowered their spending.
Michelson contends the policy is creating inflationary pressures for everything from food to fuel. And economist Robert Kuttner says if the Fed ends up having to raise rates to respond to that, it could lose the only tool it's had to stimulate the economy.
That would be the worst of all worlds. That would be stagflation, where on the one hand you have inflation, and on the other hand higher interest rates just are another dead weight on the economy.
That leaves the Fed with what Kuttner calls not a lot of wholesome choices. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
It's a reasonable thought to expect that low interest rates would help the housing market. Sadly, the free markets are rarely reasonable. A report out this morning shows home prices fell for the 8th month in a row in February. Homeowners across the country have been watching the value of their biggest investments drop for 5 years now, which is changing how they manage their money and plan for the future. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
62-year-old Jake Lemon had it all planned out. The value of his Idaho house had skyrocketed. He'd sell it, make a killing, and retire like a king.
I mean, I was really well set. I had world travel plans and stuff like that, but I can't do any of that now.
When the bottom fell out of the housing market, Lemon's house lost 40% of its value. He did sell it for a fraction of what it was worth at the peak of the housing bubble. He did make a small profit. Now he's hunkered down, saving money. So is everybody else. Alan Levinson is chief economist at T. Rowe Price.
What we're seeing is less of ability to spend beyond our means. And the clearest way to see that is just to look at the personal saving rate, which was around 2% in 2007 and is now close to 6%.
We can't use our houses as nest eggs anymore. Gone are the days when rising home values funded our retirements or college tuition for our kids. Gone are those home equity loans we took out to build a deck or buy new furniture. Jonathan Basile is an economist at Credit Suisse. He says it'll take a while for consumers to start spending more. And even then, they're just going to open their wallets a crack.
They're only going to do it slowly. They're not going to turn themselves upside down and dump all the money out.
Basile says the very slow growth in consumer spending means a very slow recovery for the economy as a whole. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Last month, the pharmaceutical company Forest Laboratories got nailed for marketing its two top-selling antidepressants for use in kids before the FDA said that they could do that. The company settled out of court for $300 million. Pretty routine stuff, happens all the time. But it's what happened next that we're interested in. Forest Labs, actually its CEO Howard Solomon, got a letter from the Department of Health and Human Services. And the contents of that letter have the healthcare industry all shook up. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Gregory Warner has the story.
The letter said that CEO Howard Solomon would be personally banned from selling drugs to the government. That means Medicare, Medicaid, the VA, every major customer if you're a drug company. Kirk Ogrosky represents healthcare clients for the law firm Arnold & Porter.
If you can't do business with the government and you're a healthcare provider, it's almost impossible to operate.
So this is basically telling them you got to fire your CEO.
It's a career ender for the CEO.
It doesn't usually go this way. Normally, drug companies that do wrong pay a fine. Last year, they paid out a record $4.5 billion. Holding CEOs responsible for corporate wrongdoing is an aggressive new approach by the government. Malcolm Sparrow is author of License to Steal, about drug fraud.
So what this does is gives the government the right to exclude executives who either controlled the company or were in a position where they should have controlled the company.
Howard Solomon built Forest Labs from a vitamin company into a pharmaceutical giant. And he was never actually accused of knowing that his sales reps were illegally marketing the drugs, Celexa and Lexapro, as options for children.
If a CEO can get away with saying, I had no idea that illegal acts were going on in my company, there's an incentive for saying that.
Dr. Adrian Few Berman studies pharmaceutical marketing at Georgetown University Medical Center. Forest Labs said in a statement that Solomon may step down temporarily while he fights the ban in court. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Traders didn't pay that housing report. No, never mind. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Oh, to be Ford CEO Alan Mulally today. This morning, Ford reported its quarterly profits rose an astounding 22%. That's a nifty $2.6 billion in the bank for Ford. The last time the company made as much money in Q1 was back in the days of the SUV boom. But smaller cars led the way this time. Rising gas prices do tend to concentrate the consuming mind. And Ford is not the only one profiting. Toyota dealers are having a hard time keeping up with demand for that very symbol of fuel efficiency, the Prius. You factor in a production slowdown from the earthquake in Japan, and used Prii are selling at a premium, too. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
There are the regular sales commissions. And then there are these. Toyota of Hollywood is paying employees a $500 finder's fee for every used Prius they bring in.
Salesmen can go on Craigslist. They can go on autotrader.com. They can go into the newspaper. Anywhere they can find a used Prius, we'll buy it.
Don Mushin is the general manager there. A lot of people want fuel-efficient cars right now, and there's a Prius shortage because of the earthquake. And Mushin says he has to have something to offer Prius buyers. Tom Santospago runs a Toyota dealership in Maine. He stocked up on used Prius models earlier in the year, but he's afraid that by midsummer he won't have any left at all. He says Toyota realizes it's a big problem.
They're telling us to call our lease customers, move them ahead a year, move them ahead 2 years, move them ahead 6 months, get them out of their car and take their car and trade.
But it's not clear where he's supposed to get new vehicles to replace them. Jonathan Banks follows the used car market at the National Automobile Dealers Association. He says prices on used Prius models are up 30% since the beginning of the year. That's more than for other used cars, though those are also in high demand.
Prices have accelerated on all the fuel-efficient vehicles since mid-March, and we're attributing some of that to the anticipation that inventory will be tighter from the production disruptions in Japan.
With gas prices still going up, it could be a long summer for Toyota dealers and buyers chasing ever fewer Prius cars. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The protests in the Middle East have brought, in some cases, sharp political change. But some of the economic fundamentals have been slower to adapt. Others aren't ever going to change, starting with this one. People gotta eat. This week, we're going to look at the role of American businesses in the changing economics of the Middle East. And we're going to start in the farm country of the Pacific Northwest with Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
The tractor gets a tune-up as Randy Cease gets ready to plant his soft white wheat. He's a third-generation farmer with about 1,300 acres of rolling hills south of Spokane, Washington. It's a long way from Cairo, but the relationship is closer than you might think.
When you look at the numbers for this year, Egypt right now is the number one buyer of all U.S. wheat.
Foreign markets are absolutely vital for farmers like Cease.
In the Pacific Northwest, we have to find a home for 90% of it. There's only 10% domestic market here.
Egypt is a swing buyer. They turn to American suppliers when they can't find cheaper wheat elsewhere. But he says another Arab country is a more consistent buyer.
You wouldn't think that Yemen would end up buying a lot of wheat from us when you look at logistically how far away it is. But they've traditionally been the number four buyer of our soft white wheat over many years.
Cease has visited Yemen on trade missions. He recently canceled another trip because of the current unrest. But together, Yemen and Egypt buy about 22% of the wheat from the Pacific Northwest. Could new governments in those countries hurt business?
We have some definite fears there.
He remembers what happened after the Iranian Revolution.
Some years up to 30% of our wheat was going into that country, and that went from that to zero.
A boycott is considered unlikely in Egypt, something that becomes clear if you visit a government bakery in Cairo. Men put dough in a big machine that looks like a relic from the Industrial Revolution. Government bakeries sell pita bread for about a penny apiece, far below cost. It's a dietary staple for most Egyptians, like 30-year-old Amani.
Every day, we Egyptians can't live without bread.
The word for bread over here in Egypt, the Arabic word that they use is aish, and aish in Arabic means life, and that's how important bread is.
Dick Pryor is the regional trade representative for U.S. Wheat Associates in Cairo. He says the government bakeries stayed open even during the height of Egypt's revolution.
They were working 24 hours a day under a lot of pressure, but they made sure that they had the bread out to the people.
Is there any chance that a new government would end bread subsidies?
If the government stopped subsidizing wheat, they would have a lot of riots. I mean, it would make Tahrir Square look kind of small.
In the past, there have been riots when the price of bread increased in Egypt. So even if new regimes aren't close allies of the U.S., they need wheat to help secure their own political stability.
Wheat is so dear to all the whole Middle East. I don't think very much is going to change no matter what kinds of governments come out in all these areas where they've had revolutions. I think we're still going to be able to do business out here.
Instead of shrinking, opportunities appear to be growing for American farmers. Pryor says Iran has recently made reforms that reopen a market for U.S. wheat. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Julia Simon helped produce that story for us from Cairo. Coming up tomorrow, another American export to the Middle East that's rising in value, political consultants. Coming up, reading, writing, and most of all, arithmetic in Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
We have declining property values, and we just can't afford to have property taxes maintained at these levels, let alone go up.
How are you going to pay for schools? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 115 points today, almost 1%, closed at 12,595. The Nasdaq put on 21 points, 0.75%, wrapped up at 2847. The S&P 500 gained 11 points, 0.9%, finished at 1347. Several big companies had better than expected earnings. 3M posted a 2% gain. Ford, we mentioned their profits, drove up 0.75%. You'd have thought it had been higher. UPS hauled in 0.9% today. UBS, the biggest bank in Switzerland, rose almost 6% after announcing strong profits. Mixed day for U.S. banks, though Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan Chase cashed in more than 1%, but Bank of America dropped 1.75% today. Bond prices rose ahead of the Fed's meeting that we told you about. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.30%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Every 2 weeks, Freakonomics brings something special to Marketplace.
You sent me $5, man.
Wasn't that nice of me? Yeah.
That was nice. Should I open this?
If you dare, open it.
Oh, I hate you.
Join us as we unwrap little surprises. You'll be all the richer.
I kept the $5, by the way, from the lottery thing. I kept
them. I've noticed.
All right.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by removing your personal data from the internet and stopping unwanted mail. Reputation.com. Marketplace is supported by iShares Exchange Traded Funds. Learn more about their ETFs at 1-800-iShares or iShares.com. iShares, keep evolving. By Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases data on durable goods orders for March. President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama are in Chicago taping an episode of the Oprah Winfrey Show. And Ebert Fest gets underway in Champaign, Illinois. The film festival is hosted by none other than critic Roger Ebert himself. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
We're back. It's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's almost nothing you can do in this digital economy, from using a smartphone to getting cash out of an ATM, that doesn't leave some kind of digital footprint. Companies use that data, as we know, to make money, which for some rankles on two counts. One, the privacy part of it. Two, it's our data. And more often than not, the businesses that collect it have no interest whatsoever in sharing it with us. University of Chicago economist Richard Thaler says they ought to. Richard Thaler, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Kai.
So your basic idea is you want to have companies give all of this data that they gather on us back to us so we can use it. Do I have that right?
That's exactly right.
All right, so what are we going to do with it?
Well, depends on the domain. Let's start with, say, calling plan for our smartphone.
All right.
Let's suppose you're about to buy a new one and you're shopping around and you'd like to know what the best plan is for you. If you go onto the website of your carrier, there will be some information there about your past usage, but not in a way that easily translates into the questions you'd have to answer to shop. What I'm proposing is that in this context, your cell phone provider would be required to give you an electronic summary of all the ways you've used the phone, say, for the last couple of years. Now, it's not with the idea that you would ever look at that file.
Yeah.
Instead, with one click, you'd go to some website, and they would take that data and with one click say, oh, I see the way you use your phone and the way you pay your bills. We suggest if you stick with this provider, you go with Plan C, but you might want to think of this other provider that seems like it might be better for you.
My guess would be that my cell phone carrier would, just on principle, just because it will say this data is ours and we have it, they would be reluctant to share it with us, let alone some third party that could help me optimize the data.
Well, I think that's right, which is the reason why I think regulators should require them to do it. And there is a bill that has been presented by the unlikely team of John McCain and John Kerry that is mostly concerned with privacy issues. And those are certainly important. But there's a section of the bill that could easily be expanded to include this. So my mantra is, it's my data. Give it back.
Yeah, which makes a lot of sense. But there seems to me, in the last week or so, we've had all this news about the iPhone collecting your data and keeping track of where you are, and the Supreme Court had a case this morning on data mining. It does seem that there is a very large shrug that comes from consuming America, that a lot of people just go, this is kind of the way it is. And, you know, Apple sells 7.5 million iPhones every year.
Well, that may be an appropriate shrug. It depends on what these companies are doing with this data. All I'm suggesting is that there's kind of an upside of this data collection that isn't being utilized. And it's because the firms that are collecting the data want to keep it for themselves. And that may be understandable. It's particularly understandable if releasing the data would empower us all to be better shoppers.
Stands to reason, too, doesn't it, that a company that is more forthcoming with our data, that gives it back to us, would, in theory, attract greater market share. Consumers would be more likely to gravitate toward that company.
Well, they would, unless the company is attracting the consumers precisely through obfuscation. So I view this as a way of rewarding companies that are attracting customers through higher quality or lower prices rather than through skullduggery.
Richard Thaler is a professor of economics at the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago. Thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Local school districts across the country are finalizing their budgets for next year, budgets that are, in most places, funded with local property taxes, which means you know what's coming next. Falling home prices, like the Case-Shiller report we got today, means school revenues are down, and residents are in no mood to approve tax increases to pay for schools. Those battles between homeowners, parents, and school boards are in sharp relief in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, where the budget is going to be put to a vote tomorrow. Marketplace's Janet Babin explains there are enough characters and plot lines and overacting to make Cherry Hill's budget drama read like a bad high school play.
Scene 1.
Ponzio's, a popular Cherry Hill diner. Cozy vinyl booths line the walls.
Hello, how are you doing today? Can I get you a drink?
Martin Chorovsky sits down for a burger and a decaf.
The infamous Diners of Cherry Hill.
What is it about New Jersey and diners?
I don't know.
He may not know about diners, but Chorovsky does know very well about another Cherry Hill institution, its Stellar Public Schools. He's president of the Cherry Hill Teachers Union. Those teachers can brag that 95% of the students they teach go on to college. Not bad in one of the state's largest and most diverse suburban districts. Teacher salaries here average $54,000 a year and can go up to $100,000. Families like Chorovsky's moved to this suburb right across the bridge from Philadelphia for the education.
I left the Philadelphia schools after my daughter got stabbed there. She wouldn't turn over her homework to somebody, so the person took a pencil and jabbed it right through her hand onto the desk. A couple stitches later, and a sale sign went up on our house.
To support their schools, Cherry Hill residents pay some of the highest property taxes in the nation. According to the Tax Foundation, the town is among the top 10 communities with the highest tax burden relative to home value. In 2009, about $5,600 a year for the median homeowner. But a revolt's been brewing. Last year, Governor Chris Christie, a Republican, urged voters to turn down any local budget that hiked property taxes but didn't freeze teacher wages. Here's Christie addressing the state legislature.
Is it fair to have any public employees getting 4-5% salary increases every year, even when inflation is at 0%, paid for by our citizens who are struggling to survive?
Christie's message got through. Residents voted down more than half of all school budgets. Cherry Hill's took a $2.5 million cut. Then Christie gave millions of Cherry Hill's surplus money to ailing schools.
You're literally stunned. It was just something that you never happened before, nothing that you could really fathom or comprehend.
That's Cherry Hill School Budget Director Jim Devereaux. He says the district had to cut more than 100 positions and reduce teacher raises. This year, the district came in with a lower tax bill. But because Cherry Hill home values have gone down so much, residents will actually pay a higher tax rate than they did last year. It'll work out to about $100 more for the average family.
Scene 2.
Cherry Hill High School West.
Good afternoon, Mr. Harmon. Please call extension.
Enter dedicated English and drama teacher Carolyn Messias, guiding 7th period through Shakespeare rehearsals.
We're going to go into Brandon's Othello rap.
Who's doing shrew?
Masias teaches in the district, but also lives here. She worries about her taxes going up. 2 years ago, her husband lost his job at Circuit City.
And that put us in a very serious position because I couldn't support the two of us, but I love my job.
Because of budget cuts, Masias' thespians and other students have to hand over $80 in activity fees for after-school programs. Another side effect of a lean budget, bigger class size. Those are the kinds of changes that make heavily taxed parents furious.
Scene 3.
Cherry Hill School Board Meeting. A few dozen attend, mostly teachers and parents, like Larry Wong. His two kids are in middle school.
It seems to me that the children's education has kind of been put on the back burner. Middle school has now classes that have 35, 36 kids in a class.
The school board also hears from taxpayers without kids in school, like Robert Shin. He's part of a tax reform group in Cherry Hill.
We have declining property values, vastly reduced state aid, and we just can't afford to have property taxes maintained at these levels, let alone go up more.
Mrs. George?
Yes.
Mrs. Maddock?
After a few hours of mind-numbing district business, the school board unanimously passes a preliminary budget, 2% higher than last year's. But the end of this play is still being workshopped. Residents write the final act tomorrow when they vote on the school budget. In Cherry Hill, New Jersey, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733. By Cargill, an international producer and marketer of food, agricultural, financial, and industrial products and services. Information at Cargill.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, ladies and gentlemen, I am pleased to say we have a winner.
Affleck! Affleck!
Those are the not-so-dulcet tones of one Dan McKeag of Hugo, Minnesota. Mr. McKeag is, in fact, the new voice of Aflac, the insurance company whose mascot is that annoying duck. The job came open, as you might remember, after comedian Gilbert Gottfried was fired for tasteless tweets about the earthquake in Japan. And while I am happy for Mr. McKeag that he got the job, it does kind of sound the same, doesn't he? Kind of the point, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 115 points, almost 1%. The NASDAQ put on 21 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 gained 11.9%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid, and that is where you ought to turn tomorrow for the latest and earliest in business and economic news. Coming up next time, back here on The Big Show.
Basically, all you have to do is click a big start button, and then it will start listening on the network.
Software that lets everyday people spy on each other. Yes, it's that easy. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.